This podcast is brought to you by TECH, the Therapeutics Education Collaboration, evidence-based drug therapy made practical and fun.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 159th episode of the Therapeutics Education Collaboration podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences here at the University of British Columbia in partly cloudy, overcast, but still lovely Vancouver, British Columbia.
I'm sure the listeners look forward to our weather forecasts, weather observations. They're not forecasts.
Well, no, it's not. Well,
especially because they receive them, not to mention the fact that most of them aren't in the same cities we're in. But then on top of it, they're often at least a day late, if not weeks late, by the time they get posted.
And all I have to say, Mike, is it's so good to have you back.
So I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family physician and an associate professor here at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And I just wanted to let you know that I apologize for taking a break for the last little while. But we had a bit of a family health emergency, and that has all settled out now. So happy to be back.
And like I said, and I won't say it again, glad to have you back.
Yeah. And the listeners can sense the sarcasm.
I was hoping they could sense the love.
Hard to tell the difference.
Yeah. I'm giving you a Skype hug right at this very moment.
Oh, God. I'm feeling queasy. So what are we going to do today, James?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. So what we would like to do, and maybe we'll probably be doing this, Mike, probably over a two or three podcasts. No idea where – we never know where these things go. But what we thought we would do is spend some time going over how to help people do critical appraisal, I guess almost on by themselves, so that they don't always need to rely on a synopsis. Because, you know, it really, I think the whole concept of critical appraisal, and I don't want people to all of a sudden shut off their podcast right now when they hear the word critical appraisal, because I know sometimes that puts people into a coma.
Sometimes.
Oh, maybe all the time. And but what we really want to do is critical appraisal skills are really so important. I mean, they are almost replacing things like the stethoscope and the prescription pad for an essential ability or tool to be able to do these things. And Mike and I have been doing sort of critical appraisal and learning it. A lot of it's being self-taught. And what we wanted to do is just pass on some of that, what we did wrong, and tell you how to, or give you some tips and suggestions about how to do it properly.
Yeah. So, if you had no limbs, you could count on your fingers and toes how many courses I've taken on critical appraisal.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think you actually need to take courses on it. I think you need to review a few papers, use resources like ours, things like ACP Journal Club, that kind of thing, to look at papers as well and get a sense for what kind of things to keep an eye out for, because they will, in their short editorials or in our discussions, will give you hints of the things that go wrong with papers. And then when you look at them, you recognize it as well, and pretty soon you're able to tease out these things as well.
And I think a lot of it, a lot of the sort of the reticent to do it is because there's a sense, an overwhelming sense that I just can't possibly do it. And in fact, at least it's been my experience, is that when you give even people who don't know anything about a clinical trial, get them to read it, if they don't get caught up in the massiveness of the whole thing, they can actually, you know, do okay with it.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Often people will resist the idea that, well, it's too complicated. And actually, a ton of it is common sense.
No, exactly. And so that's what we're going to attempt to do over the next few podcasts, to do that. Because it really, well, all I can say, if Mike and I can do it, you guys can do it.
They sent a monkey into space. they let us critically appraise.
They're exactly the same thing. So I think, you know, when it comes to critical appraisal, one of the key things that you the very premise of critical appraisal is that you ultimately want to go, can I trust the results that I've seen? That's one of the key parts of critical appraisal, and that's why we sort of do the critique of the trial design.
Right, and it's not just, and sometimes people like to turn this into a black and white thing, and we don't want to leave you with that idea. Like many of the clinical trials you'll read will not be perfect. In fact, I haven't seen one that's truly perfect yet. But are they believable enough to change my practice, and to what degree?
Yeah, and so that's almost like skipping one step, because that depends on the magnitude and what they actually looked at. It's, can you even trust the results in the first place? Is why we look at, you know, whether it's randomized, whether it's allocation concealment, and all that sort of stuff. And then if we can trust the results, should they make a difference in our in what we do?
Right.
He says convincingly. So one of the things that I try to let people know when I'm sort of doing critical appraisal is, you know, at least the way I think about it, is that critical appraisal always starts with a question in my mind. And do you think we should go over the PICO approach? I don't know if you use that much, Mike.
I don't, but I think it's again, almost common sense.
Right. So, yeah.
I think you can go over that list, and I'll chime in. Mainly because I don't want to make a mistake, because I don't use it that much.
Yeah. So we have this is sort of the why we do or how we start off with critical appraisal. And again, I think, Mike, you're right. It's common sense. So where we start off with is, we have a patient who has a condition, and we want to know, does an intervention or a treatment compared to another intervention or a comparator, does it change outcomes? And that comparator could be placebo. It could be no treatment. So we call it PICO. So in a patient, that's the P, does an intervention, whatever it is, that's the I, compared to a comparator, whatever that is, change the outcomes. And so that's why we call it a PICO approach. And so the outcomes is a key part of the whole PICO question is that we, are those the clinically important outcomes?
And you will find clinical trials that, although relatively good, will not match what you're looking for because they fail in one or more of those categories alone. So,
yes.
For example, I was looking at some I had a question in my practice around sexually transmitted diseases. And yes, James, it was in my practice.
Ah.
A personal thing.
No, but in that, but when you said practice, there were those quotation marks around it.
No, there weren't. So, and one of the studies that I found was seemed to be on target until I read the population. In other words, the patients that they were using, and they were people who were in refugee camps in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that probably doesn't correlate very strongly with my practice population. So that's just one example,
yeah.
But it might be interventions that you don't regularly use. I won't read a study when it's interventions that I know that I'll never be prescribing in my practice,
yes.
Or very unlikely to be prescribing. For example, there may be IV interventions, IV drugs, or drugs that are only available by IV that I wouldn't regularly have access to. Or another good example is because I'm mainly working in the community. Or another example is, some drugs are specially prescribed by clinics involved with particular diseases. So let's say a rheumatoid condition in which tumor necrosis factor type drugs and biologic agents are used. Well, we don't prescribe those regularly. So I might be interested in the periphery, but I don't need to delve into that research as carefully as I do for patients in my own practice.
Because specifically, you're not making the decision.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I'll look into some of that, but I don't need to get down to the nitpicky details of critical appraisal. Most of us don't do that.
Yeah. Or the nitty gritty.
Yeah. Yeah. Nitpicky or nitty gritty. And then the other one is comparator. And there have been clinical trials where comparators are so awful as to make the clinical trial almost useless. I won't go as far as to say useless, but an example of that was comparing an oral agent for an antifungal or a fungal condition, an oral antifungal versus amphotericin B given orally, which is not even absorbed. So we know effectively it was a placebo trial.
Right. So what you're saying, you mean the comparator and the intervention have to be have relevance to you.
Yeah, they have to match up and be relevant.
Right.
Exactly. And then the last thing is outcomes. And I think, James, you could probably give lots of examples where the outcome is something that's really not relevant to us. It might be a surrogate. That would be the classic scenario where you would look at how much microalbumin has changed.
Right.
And or, you know, the serum rhubarb level has been modified by this product.
Yeah, because I would look at that and go, let's say this drug was able to demonstrate that it lowered cholesterol 10% more than another one. Let's say that was a real finding. I wouldn't care.
Yeah, exactly.
So why would I critically appraise it if I didn't care about the outcome? And so that's why when we're talking about outcomes, you know, the most important outcome in general, but not always, is death. And then everything else falls down below that. I mean, things, you know, like cardiovascular events and strokes and quality of life and all of that sort of stuff, all the way down. And then surrogate markers come way at the end of that important outcomes.
Right, exactly. Things that have meaning to patients. So in a sense, what we're talking about here is, when I have my residents and learners do critical appraisal, the first thing I ask them to consider is, what are they trying to show you with this work? And what do you already know? And can this change what you do? And those are kind of the kind of that delves into that PICO piece.
Right.
Is this a relevant article for you to even take the 10 minutes to rapidly critically appraise?
No, exactly. Yeah. So that's the PICO part. And there are other ways of doing it, but it's, you know, patient intervention, comparator, and outcome. So now, obviously there's going to be a study. And for every study, there are basically always numerical differences between the groups when it comes to these different outcomes. And so, and that's just because, you know, you'll never have exactly the same number of, or very rarely have the same number of deaths in each group or the same number of MIs in the group, because, you know, you're studying thousands of people or even hundreds, and you're going to see that. And so what you want to do as far as critical appraisal is you want to figure out what caused those differences. So there's always differences. You got to figure out what caused those differences. And so this is really just a process of elimination. And so the very first one that we do, way it's looked at, is, was the difference due to chance? And that's where the whole concept of statistical assessment comes in, is trying to figure out, was it a chance or a non-chance occurrence?
And this is, you know, this is one of the more challenging bits for people in interpreting research. What does that p-value or those confidence intervals actually mean?
Yeah, and we'll get to that when we get to that process further on. But one thing I will add whether or not it's a chance occurrence is it's an important part, but you don't need to get really caught up in the whole statistical analysis of it. And we'll get that when we get later on. You need to be aware that it was done, but whether there was a Bonferroni procedure done and all that sort of stuff, I don't even know what that is. I think it's a place somewhere in Spain, but I'm not sure.
I agree. And it's it's funny because when you're teaching critical appraisal in the small group setting, inevitably someone will ask you, they'll be reading that last paragraph in the analysis section. And that's where all the statistical gobbledygook is. Mm-hmm. And they'll ask, do we need to know what a Mann-Whitney U-test is or something like that? And it's so reassuring for them to hear, absolutely not.
No, but you do need to know what a p-value means and what a confidence interval means. And that has nothing to do with a Mann-Whitney test.
Exactly. Yeah. And so to get them away from worrying about those, that piece is in there for a statistician to review, for you if you're going to reanalyze their data or do a study of your own and try and copy their results.
Right.
In other words, test their results. That's what that level of information is there for. It's not for the consuming clinician.
Yeah. Or if you have some insomnia problems.
Yeah, no, I don't know if that would help insomnia. It might bring out rage.
Yeah, I would agree.
That's the kind of thing you have to keep away from people at risk of ending up on buildings with rifles and kind of things.
Exactly. And we're not trying to belittle the need for a proper statistical analysis at all. But
no, it's not for the average clinician. That's not what. Yeah, we're there to interpret the results for application to clinical practice, not to discern the validity of the statistical analysis.
No, exactly. So if in fact, based on the statistical analysis, we go, we think this was a non-chance occurrence. So by statistic, we think it was a non-chance occurrence. Then we got to go did that occurrence happen because of some sort of a bias? And when we're talking about truth and bias and all those sorts of things, that's part of the critical appraisal to go, was there something else about the study that was responsible for seeing the difference between the groups? And then if, and we'll talk about how to do that in a minute. And if it's not that, then by sort of a process of elimination, it has to be the intervention.
Right. And that's the real point of a randomized controlled trial, is to try and eliminate all the other things that can influence an outcome. So instead of, you know, in a cohort type study, you might find that minors have more of a certain condition, let's say a type of cancer. And you might go, aha, that is because they're minors and they're working in a mine. But come to find out that minors are also, let's say, more likely to smoke, and therefore that could be the thing that's impacting. In a randomized controlled trial, that shouldn't occur, because you would have balanced those different risks equally between the two groups.
Yeah. Well, but they would never actually be equal, but they would be close enough that the differences between them could not account for the difference.
Right. And also that even if there was one more smoker in one group, there would also be another risk factor that would be slightly higher in the other group. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, hopefully.
They'd end up likely. I mean, that's the point of randomization. And as you say, what differences exist, they wouldn't be meaningful.
Yeah. And the larger the trial, the greater chance you have of them being balanced, I think.
Yeah. And what's interesting is the larger the trial also, that's why many people have said you shouldn't statistically analyze for differences between baseline characteristics, because once a trial like ALHAT, for example, was more likely to find that there were differences between the baseline groups, not because that shouldn't have occurred because the trial was so big, but it also allowed for more power to determine if there were subtle differences between
yeah.
them.
Yeah, and so but what it goes to prove is that In studies that do statistical analysis of baseline characteristics, it shows you that you can do statistics on anything, yeah. regardless of whether you should.
And find out that there's a difference.
Yeah. So that's – you're absolutely right. It's an actual waste of computer and calculating time to do that,
yeah.
in my opinion, at least, because you're ultimately looking at, were the differences clinically big enough to cause the thing. And we'll get into that as we go through this process. So – I think it might be a value. I think, we're going to use an article that was in the New England Journal of Medicine as an example of how, at least, we would go through a critical appraisal step. And I think the very first thing is that I do when I'm looking, for instance, at the New England Journal of Medicine is you got to identify, and we've talked about this earlier, what are your needs? And the very first thing I do is just I read the title. And if I read the title and it has nothing to do with anything that I would ever see, I usually don't go any further.
Yeah, I think that's it. And if there's any level of uncertainty, usually a quick review of the abstract by breezing through it will tell you what was not readily apparent from the title.
Yeah. So, and I would encourage authors to have good titles, you know, to help us let us know what was actually all about. So that's the very first thing. And then, in this article, this was the ACCORD trial, and it was entitled "The Effects of Intensive Glucose Lowering in Type 2 Diabetes." Okay, that's got enough of my interest because, you know, there are a lot of type 2 diabetics. There's a lot of drugs, and we need to know that information. So I would then go further and go, okay, so I know who it's in. What were they comparing? And in this case, it was intensive therapy. Where they were targeting a glycated hemoglobin level or an A1C below 6 versus standard therapy. And the standard therapy was an A1C of between 7 and 7.9. So that one of those was the comparator and one of those was the intervention. And both of those are important to me. And obviously not to Mike.
I'm just mesmerized by this. No, I'm listening. I agree. That's how you quickly, as I mentioned earlier, you quickly look at these articles and do they have relevance to you or not? And if the answer is, I don't think I, you know, if you're a person who mainly sees palliative care now and the issue is otitis media in children, that article probably has no interest to you and it would be a waste of your time reading it.
No, exactly.
But this article if you do primary care, it would be hard. You'd be hard pressed to go through much time in your office and not see someone with diabetes.
No, exactly.
Type 2 diabetes.
No, exactly. So we're happy with what the population. We're happy with what's being compared, and then the next step is to go look at the outcomes. So, if they are just surrogate markers, you know, the cholesterol, the blood pressure, and so on, as we've talked about before, regardless of what they're going to show, it probably is not going to be a practice-changing thing because of all the issues around surrogate markers. But in this study, the primary outcome was a composite of non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, or death from cardiovascular causes, which, I don't know what, probably clinically relevant, Mike?
Yeah, I would say those are patient-oriented outcomes that matter.
Yes. And then you can have a look to go, well, you know, how long was this study, how long did the study go on? Well, you know, and if it was a 1 week trial, now it may be if the intervention was unbelievably good, maybe 1 week is a value. But in this case, you know, this was a mean duration of comparison of about 3.5 years. So that, again, puts it into a context for me. And then the very last thing that I look at in the abstract is the conclusion. And because, at least in my experience, the conclusion, if you will, is as good as it's going to get. I don't know if you found that, Mike.
Yeah, what you're meaning by that is they will take the most positive spin possible on the results of this trial.
Yeah. Or negative, depending on what they found.
Yeah, the most dramatic results.
Yes, I think that's a better way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, so I will read the conclusion, and if that conclusion was not impressive enough for me to change, so let's say that the conclusions were true and that it actually did show that, if it wasn't impressive enough for me to do anything different in practice, why would I go further?
Well, hopefully you've got enough of a life that you wouldn't.
I don't, but because it's kind of what I do, but I'm talking about people who have a life.
People outside of this discussion.
Exactly. So you can very quickly, without having to get into much more of the paper, probably ignore most of the literature.
Yeah, I tell most people that when they get something like InfoPoems or they get ACP Journal Club or Evidence-Based Medicine Journal or those kind of things that screen the literature for you, very frequently, even though those articles have been selected for potential application to primary care, many of them I would never read because they aren't related to the things that I do enough or that I feel that they're not adding much. If I look at the conclusion and I'm already and the paper seems to be promoting something that I'm already doing, then I'm not about to read that article because I have my answer.
No, exactly. And so what we're trying to say is that within 30 seconds, you can make a decision about whether you need to go further.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's, for sake of argument, at least the conclusion of this in this article was that the use of intensive therapy to target normal A1C levels for 3.5 years increased mortality and did not significantly reduce major cardiovascular events. That's kind of important.
Especially because at the time, we were doing the opposite. We were being told to aggressively manage blood sugar.
Right.
And, or as they use in this, intensively manage blood sugar. And this was running counter
right
to what we thought was the best approach.
Yeah. So if it was true, you'd want to know it as a healthcare professional who is seeing these types of patients.
Right. And you'd also, this is where I think we're going to step next is, can we believe these results?
Exactly. And so, so what Mike is alluding to in a sort of a, you know, backdoor way, if you will, is, is do we trust the results and how do you figure out if you can trust them? Not that, you know, that there's a purposeful manipulation, but can you trust that the trial was designed in a way that would eliminate the risks of bias? So how do you do that? This is where I think people get really hung up on. And it actually is, it's easier than it sounds. And a lot of it is very subjective. So what I do, and especially if I have the PDF of the document in front of me, I just type in a bunch of keywords that I'm looking for. The first one I type in is random. Now, if I'm looking at a randomized clinical trial anyway, it probably was randomized, but I, you know, for the process, you do want to know that it was randomized because, you know, it's really a key quality of the study to make sure that subjects are equally distributed and so on and so forth. So, but almost all the time we're talking about randomized controlled trials anyway, so it's not that important.
Right. And the good thing about the word random is it will also take you to a topic you're going to come up to next or in a couple is allocation concealment.
Right.
And often in clinical trials, they won't say we concealed allocation or we had allocation concealment because or something like that. They will say randomization was done this way.
Right.
And that will explain how allocation concealment occurred.
Right.
But you actually found that in the article by using the word random.
Exactly. So the next word you type in is blind. I'm glad you find that funny, Michael.
It's just funny to think that you're looking for the word blind.
Yes. But the reason you're doing that is that, you know, we talk about single-blinded, double-blinded, triple-blinded, completely blinded, or in the case of trials done in about people's vision, we call it masked.
Yes, here's another little trick. Sometimes you won't find anything with the word blinded, so use the word mask. That can also help.
No, exactly. So we want to know was the study blinded, because that helps lessen the influence of the sort of the prejudices of the subject or the researcher knowing what the patient is receiving. Now, just because a trial is not blinded doesn't mean that it's a bad trial. For instance, the UK PDS trial, for which we all now use metformin, was not blinded at all.
Right. And if you were looking at a study which one arm was amputation, it would be very hard to blind that study.
Nigh on impossible.
So there are times where blinding is difficult, if not impossible. And so you can't always expect blinding to be there. But then I think, James, I'm going to circumvent this and beat you to the punch, is ideally in those situations, you'd be looking for the most objective outcome
exactly
possible. So to remove the potential as much as possible of subjective reporting relating to either the patients or clinicians, those are the two primary blinded people,
right?
Knowing their outcome and therefore being influenced by that. Knowing their treatment and therefore
right.
being influenced by that.
Yeah. So it can be single blinded, which means the subject doesn't know what they're receiving, which is good. It can be double blinded, which means that neither the subject nor the investigator or / clinician knows. Now, sometimes neither of those guys are blinded, but then you can have the people who are assessing the outcomes be blinded to what each subject got. Now, if all of those guys are blind, it's called triple blinded, but you can have varying degrees of blindedness, I guess.
Yeah, and you can also have the investigators blinded, you can have the analyzers blinded, so they analyze the data they just know that group A and group B, they don't know which it was, and they spit out the values and the p-values and the magnitude of effect, etc., based only on A and B, and only after all that's done do they unmask the data.
Yeah.
So you can actually have, and if you're wondering how do you not blind clinicians and not blind patients, but keep the people who are recording outcomes blinded, well, you could send someone in, for example, an amputation study, you could have the person sitting in a bed all covered up and send the outcome person in and have them do a quality of life survey with the patient and leave without them ever having had a chance to figure out whether they had an amputation or not.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So you can, if enough thought is put into these trials ahead of time, you can do a lot more blinding than is what originally felt. So if you remember the dabigatran trial, that was unblinded trial, and some have accused that of them not trying hard enough in the blinding. And
it would have been exceptionally hard. But part of the dabigatran was it was blinded to dose.
Yeah, it was blinded to dose, but not versus warfarin.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So now you've done those two things. Now you type in the word allocation. And I know this is one of your favorite topics, Mike. So now, unfortunately, when you type in allocation, you often don't find that word in there. But you can sometimes, because people are starting to put that in more. So what you're looking for is the whole concept of allocation concealment. And you want to know if the researcher could have figured out what treatment the next subject would receive, because that may impact, the whole processes of the study, because it can obviously affect randomization.
Right. So the fear here is that I will know the direction of the next patient. So I will know that they're going to end up, for example, receiving the intervention. And I either believe the intervention is bad for them or good for them. And so if I knew they were going to get it and I was worried about them getting the new intervention, I didn't have as much faith in it, I might ask them to come back tomorrow and then randomize another patient who I'm not so concerned about and allocate them. And therefore, I have circumvented the randomization process. And how do you do that? Well, if you've got trials have had them where they've posted the randomization list on a wall, and the investigators can actually, the people enrolling patients can actually go up and look at it. They've had it where you can draw names from hats, or sorry, not names, but numbers from hats. So you would draw, let's say, a piece of paper out of a hat, and it would say intervention, and you would know which group the patient was in. You could, if you wanted to circumvent, you just drop it back in and redraw from the hat.
Yeah.
You can have it on an envelope, but the envelope be white and the writing is dark enough that it can be seen by holding it up to a light. So there's a whole bunch of ways you can actually circumvent the randomization concealment or the allocation concealment, if you like. Allocation just means you're allocating or putting people into their groups. And you want to conceal that because investigators and clinicians have been known to circumvent that in the past and put people in groups that they felt it can be because they felt that that's what was better for the patient, or it can be because they're not comfortable. So for example, a surgeon might feel, yeah, but I don't want to do this type of surgery on this patient, so I'll try another envelope and see if I can get what I want.
Right. And Mike and I have an ongoing debate about the importance of this and the magnitude in which this occurs. I won't tell you which way we both lean on this.
I don't think we don't debate about the importance of
it. No, no.
What we debate is it a surrogate of other outcomes? Is it a surrogate of overall trial quality?
Right.
Or is it truly what appears to be the most important piece in the quality assessment of a randomized controlled trial?
Exactly.
And we don't... And we can debate it because
we don't
neither
really know.
Of us really knows.
No, and we're planning on actually at some point, although we've been planning this probably for about 3 or 4 decades, to look at it in more detail. But nonetheless, what you want to do is, if possible, you want that the investigators cannot have an impact on it. And probably one of the best ways is to have sort of a central randomization by some sort of a third party.
Right.
And that, in theory, should get rid of most of the problems of allocation concealment, but it actually could still bypass it in certain ways.
Yeah, you can. The the best is a third party, so having to phone somewhere else, so like a pharmacy, mm-hmm. where you say, I've got patient A, I want to enroll, that's considered good allocation concealment. The other one is opaque envelopes that can't be seen through, and then you open them up and you're stuck with them once you've opened them.
Yeah.
So those are the two main ways that you can provide good allocation concealment. When I search for it using this trick of the search button or the find button in the PDF, I use allocate or conceal.
Right.
Those are the two ways that I find most effective to find it. Now, granted, you have to remember that lots of series have been done on this, and the clear reporting of allocation or randomization concealment is
unclear. It's unclear.
Is unfortunately rare.
Yeah.
So not rare, but uncommon.
Yeah.
Even in the highest clinical trials. So it's just be forewarned that there's a fair chance you won't find it.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing is type in the word intent. Because what you're looking for there is the whole concept of intention to treat. And what you want to know is if were all the subjects that were randomized to one treatment or another, did they get analyzed at the end according to what they were, to the group that they were put in? Now, that may sound somewhat counterintuitive, because it is possible that you could be randomized to a certain treatment and then never end up getting it because you died because of the because of the group that you were being put into. You were so surprised that the randomization process killed you. But now I am marginally exaggerating.
No, I would never say that.
No. But what? So there's all sorts of things that could happen. Well, but
yeah, in Al-Hat, for example, which I would say is probably the best study to determine what is the first line drug for hypertension. In that study, if you were randomized to chlorothalidone, for example, I think 30% of people were taking one of the other two interventions instead. And yet all of those people were analyzed like they took chlorothalidone.
Right.
Because that's what – so it's all in the phrasing, intention to treat. It's how you intended to treat them.
Right. And most people suggest it's the most conservative way to look at the results.
Right, exactly. It's the safest, because if you say and I can completely see this. Well, those people who were taking amlodipine from the very beginning should probably, even though they were randomized to chlorothalidone, should probably be analyzed in the amlodipine group. The problem with that is twofold. First, if you open up and allow the investigators to modify and shift patients around in analysis, you're, in a sense, opening Pandora's box.
Right.
And then on the second problem is, why did that person who was allocated to receive chlorothalidone take amlodipine? Is there something different about the kind of person who would switch right away?
Right.
And if there is, shouldn't they stay in the group they were assigned? Because it might not be a positive thing that makes them. So that and so that's why, as James said, it's probably the most conservative way to approach it. Is it perfect? No. And some of the studies show that it can have a large impact on biasing the results, up to 50% in one series, all the way to having no impact. So it's important. And it will vary with the different clinical trials, but it's important that you know whether intention to treat occurred. And that should always be your goal, to see that.
Because and ultimately, what, as you've sort of mentioned, you're trying to avoid the problem of dropouts, crossovers, and that's the whole point of why we randomized it in the first place. So Now there's another thing called a per protocol analysis, which means you only look at the people who completed the entire study. And there are some benefits of doing it that way. And in fact, when you're looking at a non-inferiority study, and we don't even need to get into that right now, but it actually reduces the chance of falsely concluding a non-inferiority. But don't worry about it. But nonetheless, a lot of clinical trials are looked at from an intention to treat and a per-protocol analysis.
Right.
The way I think about it, if looking at it both ways shows similar results, it makes me happy.
That's exactly it. I was going to say this. So one of the things that if you see a large difference between the per protocol analysis and the intention to treat analysis, you should wonder yourself, what went on in this clinical trial to make these analyses so different? Was it that people weren't following the protocol? And a really good example of that is the early PSA studies. For example, if you looked at the Quebec study of PSA, less than 25% of those randomized to receive regular PSA screening ever, less than 25% ever got any screening at all. So the per protocol and the intention to treat analysis are very different
right. In
that study, because so few followed protocol that if you looked at the few that did, there was a difference.
Yeah, but that all comes because where the study was done. Quebec never really... They're off doing their own thing.
There's so many reasons, as a person from an Anglophone province, you should not be talking right now.
I love Quebec.
Well, I can tell you one thing. They don't love you
anymore. Montreal is a lovely city. I just don't like the Canadians. And by that, I mean the Montreal Canadians.
now you're really digging.
I'm in big trouble.
Why don't you talk about follow-up?
Yeah, so the next thing that you do is, as far as you're looking for areas of bias, is you type in the word follow. And because what you want to know is if all subjects were followed up for the duration of the study. And now, the question is what's an acceptable level of dropout? And there is no magic number to that. Some people, I've read articles where they say 20%.
That's the most commonly quoted kind of cutoff. But, you know, there is, as you're going to point out, there is, or as you already said, there's no magic to that number. Right. If you have a clinical trial where I always use this example delivery, and you enroll women when they come in dilated to 4 centimeters and in active labor, and your loss to follow-up is 15%, I would wonder why. How can you lose 15% of women that can only go in one direction? That baby has to come out at this stage.
So you know why you know that?
Because you're a doctor. I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
So that would be an example where I would not tolerate a loss to follow-up of close to 20%. That would, right. That to me would be something would be wrong in the clinical trial.
Yeah. And some of the most difficult ones we deal with are the schizophrenia trials.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the loss to follow-up sometimes gets close to 100%.
You know, if you follow that clinical trial long enough.
Yeah.
Another one is dementia trials, and yeah. Which I find maybe, you know, we could joke about that all day about they get lost or they can't remember to go to their follow-up.
No, but that would be way worse than saying something about Quebec.
Yeah, it would be. So I won't say that. But it is concerning to me because where are these people going?
Right.
They're often institutionalized, and yet the loss to follow-up is very large in these clinical trials. It's not because other horrible things are happening, like they're passing away or something. They're actually, those would still be recorded as patients in the clinical trial. So something else is going on. And so you can't legitimately say, if you held schizophrenia trials to a standard of a 20% loss to follow-up and you were looking at a 3-year or 2-year schizophrenia trial, maybe you could find one that had 80% like a follow-up that was at 80% and only 20% loss. But I don't perceive that. I don't think that would ever be possible.
No, I think most of them are upwards of the neighborhood of you know, 60 to 70% loss.
Yeah, yeah. And I think and that is still going to be the best evidence you're going to get about the management of schizophrenia.
No, exactly. So how do you assess it? It's quite subjective. If there's a large number of outcomes in each group, then a loss to follow-up is somewhat acceptable. It's when you have a very small number of subjects have an outcome, then a smaller percentage loss to follow-up becomes a problem. But no one can really tell you what the right number is. You just need to look at it and go, huh, that seems like a lot.
Yeah, or that doesn't seem too bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is somewhat vague. And so those are the key things. There's one more thing that we'll talk about, which is conflict of interest. But those, I think, 5 things that we just talked about, 5 things, are the key features of critical appraisal when you're looking for bias. Now, there is no – I can't give you the answer of how many of those things you have to be a good trial. There are scales that have looked at that. But it's really just sort of a, if you will, a gut feeling, Mike. I don't know.
Yeah, and in fact, Cochrane would agree with you. They're getting away from using overall scores. They really only use those that kind of thing now for looking at sensitivity analysis within the meta-analysis. But they don't really use that. What they do instead is, you know, they'll look at intention to treat and was there high risk of bias, low risk of bias, or was it unclear?
Right. Yeah.
And then they don't disregard the study entirely for that. What they want you to do is then consider the importance of that clinical trial in reference to the rest of the other studies.
Yeah. So the ACCORD trial that we've been talking about, it was randomized. It was not blinded. There wasn't a huge amount of discussion about allocation, so we're not really sure. Hopefully it was done well. It wasn't analyzed by an intent to treat, and the follow-up was, I think, all but about 1% of people were followed up. And actually, you can have a loss to follow-up, but you know, if it's a mortality trial, sometimes you can get follow-up for just that one endpoint as well.
Yeah, so, yeah, because you can track it through other means.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a whole bunch of ways of looking at follow-up. So then the very last sort of biasy thing, and if you thought we've been vague or subjective already, it's going to get even worse, and that is looking for conflicts of interest.
And who pays for the study.
Yeah, and who paid for the study. And so I think it's more important that you know versus that you're going to be able to make a judgment of whether that's a problem.
Yeah, and I think when you that's the catch here, because clinical trials that have been funded, that are funded by industry, have been shown to also have many of the quality features or be better in many of the quality features than publicly funded trials.
Right.
Now, that's also because they can afford to meet
do all
those
the right
criteria.
Things,
yeah, to do all the right things.
Yeah.
But also we know, and that this evidence is very robust as well, and probably even more robust, that industry-funded trials are more likely to find in favor of their product.
Right, but that's not so much from the trial design. That's the reporting.
Right. It's also, well, there's ways you can design a trial that for example, the reference I gave earlier of the antifungal against amphotericin, that was the other antifungal group paid for that study.
Yeah. So that's by either using an inappropriate comparator.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we know that, for example, the way outcomes were reported for the rosiglitazone data, the way MIs were reported varied depending on what group you were in.
Right.
So if you were in the rosiglitazone group, what looked like an MI, if you were in rosiglitazone, it wasn't categorized as one as often. Where if you were in the placebo group, it was categorized as an MI more often.
Right.
So there's all sorts of ways that this can manifest itself. It's really a whole podcast in and of itself. And
yeah.
We won't go into it, but you need to be cognizant of these kind of features of where, first of all, who pays for the study, and those involved, what's their relationship with the sponsor in
right.
general? What's their relationship with the sponsor?
And so in this case, in this study, the main payer for the study was the NIH, the National Institutes of Health.
They're
gunning for you. But it's important because everybody has a bias.
No.
Well, except
not,
you, Mike.
Not us.
No,
not
no,
us, James.
No. But so you need to look at that. And then – so that's who paid for the study. And then the issue is, well, what about the people who are the investigators? And at least in the case of the Accord trial, it looked like every one of them had been paid – in a variety of different ways, not necessarily because of the trial, but at some point by...
Often it's not related to the trial.
No.
It's other things that they've been paid for.
Right.
Often I'll just write when I'm writing my critical appraisal sheets for when we're doing either this show or my tools for practice or whatever, and I need to kind of summarize things, I just write lots.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Because once there's some of it, you don't need to know. You just need to know, was that happening commonly among these authors and investigators? And if it was, you need to keep that as a background thought. That has been, it's been shown to manifest itself for sure in editorials.
Right.
So if an author has had an affiliation with a manufacturer before, it's likely that the editorials he or she will write in the future will reflect positively on the manufacturer.
Yeah. So in this case, it was the NIH who paid for it. And if you want to read a list of all the drug companies in the world, just look at their conflict.
and that is very common because they would be searching out the highest profile endocrinologists and academics to participate in this clinical trial. When you do that, the drug industry would have also sought those people out as opinion leaders.
Exactly.
For speaking for them, to sit on committees, etc., or to be in their clinical trials. So you shouldn't disregard the paper because of that, because you will have a very hard time finding a prominent endocrinologist with a very high-profile position who hasn't received or hasn't had some kind of relationship with industry.
Yeah. It's not impossible, but it
gets harder.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we'll end this part of the podcast, because what we've actually covered a ton of stuff here in regards to how do you assess bias and why do we even do critical appraisal in the first place. And we've actually covered a lot of the issues that we needed to talk about, because in the next podcast, we're going to start off talking about what parts of the paper can you ignore? Because we spent a lot of time talking about what you sort of need to look at, but there's a lot of the stuff that you don't actually need to pay a whole lot of attention to, and we'll help you with that, because, you know, in this case, the Accord trial, I think there was something like 15 pages and thousands of words, and even just looking at it makes you a little bit queasy, and we want to help you out with that. So is there anything else you wanted to add, Mike?
Nope, I think that's it. Once again, James, you've hit all the high points.
Right. hopefully our listeners will agree. So, Mike, as I've said, it's good to have you back.
Glad to be back.
And we will continue our trek of looking at doing critical appraisal in the next 2 to 3 podcasts. And hopefully this is of interest to you guys, because we don't want to give you the fish. We want to teach you how to fish.
Yeah, but then they won't ever come back for our fish.
Ignore everything we've just said in the podcast. and thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Tech Podcast. We welcome any comments or questions you may have, and can find our contact information and show notes at therapeuticseducation.org.